Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the outing of an FBI confidential informant who President Trump is claiming was a spy infiltrated into his campaign, which he's demanding the Congress investigate, tweeting out that, quote, "This is bigger than Watergate." Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss how Trump is trying to gin up a campaign of phony outrage to get Devin Nunes and the junkyard dogs of the so-called Freedom Caucus to yap loudly along with Sean Hannity and the Fox News propagandists in the hope Trump can use this as an excuse to slow or shut down the Mueller investigation. We'll assess whether the revelation that a 73-year-old American professor at Cambridge University, who has been a longtime CIA and FBI informant for the administrations of Republican presidents Reagan, Bush, and Bush Jr., and was meeting with Trump's campaign officials who the FBI suspected had ties to the Russians, will be seen by the broader public as the smoking gun Trump is trying to make it appear to be. We'll also examine the latest expose from the New York Times on meetings in Trump Tower and the Seychelles brokered by the convicted child molester George Nader, who set Donald Trump Jr. up with Eric Prince, who was offering his services to the Trump campaign to use his mercenary army in the Emirates to start a war with Iran. Then we'll go to Venezuela to get an update on today's elections, which are widely seen as a choice between participating in a rigged election or boycotting the vote, thus handing the incompetent ideologue Maduro another term as the country spirals into economic ruin and social disintegration. Caracas-based journalist Virginia Lopez, who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English, joins us to discuss her article at the Toronto Globe and Mail, "In Venezuela, an Election Where No One Wins," and how the oil infrastructure in the once oil-rich country is so neglected and mismanaged that oil exports will soon grind to a halt. Then finally, James and Deborah Fellows joins us in the studio to discuss their new book just out, "Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America." James has been a national correspondent for The Atlantic for more than 35 years, and Deborah is a linguist and writer, and they have traveled into America's heartland in their small private plane to discover a surprising portrait of the civic and economic reinvention taking place outside of the view of the national media, which at a time of polarization and political dysfunction is both welcome and encouraging. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Ian, great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Scott. And I recently interviewed the Yale historian Timothy Snyder, who's got a very important new book, "The Road to Unfreedom." And the portrait that he offers us is a very accurate one, and he's a very insightful person. And essentially, we are trapped between an autocrat and a wannabe autocrat. We're trapped between Putin and Trump. And that the only way that American democracy is going to be rescued is by Robert Mueller. And every day, that appears to me to be more and more the stark choices facing us. And a lot of liberals, I spoke to a bunch of progressives the other day, who are losing heart, who think that Trump is going to win. They think he's going up in the polls and that somehow the truth will never come out and this criminal will get away with it.
Well, I'll second you on Timothy Snyder's book. I think it's a fabulous and important book, The Road to Unfreedom, and particularly in the way he traces the ideological influences on Putin and the way these, particularly a couple of Russian thinkers who are not really well known, and the way they've influenced his rule in Russia and his dealing with the Western powers. That's right. And I think right now, of course, it's ridiculous to pin all hopes on one man, Robert Mueller, and think that that he'll cure everything. You know, our system doesn't work that way. And I think back to a great speech that Learned Hand gave in Central Park in New York about a week, 10 days before the D-Day invasions, in which he says, freedom lies in the hearts of men, and it will only be preserved when the citizenry generally realizes the importance of freedom and acts on it. So it's really a high level of a public understanding of what's happened and insistence that things work the way the Constitution and the Founding Fathers intended them to work that will turn things around. And that translates into votes at the ballot box, but much more than that.
Well, but at the moment, it appears that President Trump is both at war with the truth and at war with the law. And if he wins, then that's the beginning of the end of American democracy, and we'll become more and more like Russia.
That's right. I mean, he's sort of awkwardly at war with the apparatus of government that he, in fact, heads, which is strange. I think we've never seen anything quite like that in the past, but particularly the law enforcement mechanism. So, I mean, he behaves and has, since he was sworn in, behaved like someone who feels he's on the other side of the law and feels very, very vulnerable to law enforcement investigations. And I think when we look at all the scandals that are swirling around him, we understand why. Because I think a lot of the matters we're looking at now are things that happened after he became president. Many of them have nothing to do with the Russia scandal per se. They have to do with how he deals and how he interacts with foreign governments, which seems to consistently put his personal financial interests and the interests of his family up front.
But his basic point is that the law should be working for me, not working against me. And no, I mean, that's an absurd notion.
It's completely absurd. And, you know, you have the basic principle, you know, that Thomas Paine put down at the time of the American Revolution. Who is the king in America? And he said, the law is the king. So, you know, what is fundamental to, was fundamental to the American Revolution and to the founding principles of the country is this idea that all are beholden to the law and must act consistently with it. And that certainly includes the president. In fact, I think the understanding from the beginning was anyone who became president would have to agree to considerable restrictions on how they could behave. I mean, it results in a constriction of freedoms when you obtain high public office. That of the highest magistrate of the land, as George Washington called it.
Let's turn to the outing of the 73-year-old American professor at Cambridge University, who's been a long-time source for both the CIA and the FBI, and he was used as an informant by the FBI because they had I think they had four or five FISA warrants against Carter Page. They kept renewing them. Carter Page was hanging out with Russian spies who were trying to recruit them. The Russian spies were eventually arrested and kicked out of the country. I mean, the Republicans have been trying to suggest that somehow, you know, Carter Page's civil rights were violated. I mean, it's an absurd notion. So these guys, Papadopoulos and Carter Page, come up on the FBI's radar because of their interactions with the Russians. And so they asked this guy, who's a Republican, who served Republican presidents and may well have had a role in working against Jimmy Carter on behalf of Ronald Reagan, he is obviously the right guy to talk to them. So how can Trump make a case that this is an infiltration by a spy and worse than Watergate? Are we that stupid in this country that we're going to buy that?
Well, I think it's clearly a sign of desperation because they have very few substantive defenses to throw out here. And so they're grasping at whatever they can find. Now, in this case, you know, I think what happened is pretty much what you would expect would happen. And contrary to what you've heard from Devin Nunes and from Trump, the focus of this intervention was on two individuals, and the focus was outside of the United States. It was conduct by these two individuals abroad, and their interaction with people who were believed to be or actually even known to be intelligence agents of the Russian government. And a decision was made to just check in and see, did they understand what they would do, what they were doing and who they were dealing with, just pose a few basic questions and learn a bit more information. And this was done using an asset. And now I think in this case, the person they chose was, of course, was based in the UK, was at Cambridge University, was in London frequently, and was very well known as a Republican, as a very partisan figure Republican, I'd say a fairly strident Republican, and also was, I think, pretty well known to have connections with the U.S. intelligence services going back some time. Of course, I mean, it was even discussed at length and a major feature in the New York Times at one point. So I think this was an effort to feel them out. It wasn't appointing someone as a spy to be embedded inside of the Trump campaign. And the choice, the individual that they selected and they used, seems to me to be very logical. I mean, you know, logical because they wanted an asset who would not be viewed as hostile to these people who shared their political orientation, and they wanted someone who had strong familiarity with the intelligence scene inside the UK, as this person did. And I think they had very few people they could have used for this purpose, and the person that they selected was a pretty obvious choice.
And of course, he, along with Christopher Andrews at Cambridge, apparently were alarmed by General Flynn's behavior when he was at a conference there on security, where he was consorting with a young Russian FSB honey trap, a so-called researcher, who they were writing love letters to each other, dear Misha, etc. This guy who was outed by Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept apparently was so alarmed by that that he reported that to the FBI, that the National Security Advisor is you know, being compromised by a Russian honey trap.
Well, exactly right. And he wasn't the only person who reported that. I mean, it was observed by several individuals who passed that information on to U.S. and U.K., intelligence, and I think that that whole incident is, and the fact that Flynn, after returning back to the States, didn't report what he did and who he dealt with, which, you know, everyone's required to do when you have certain levels of intelligence clearance. I think that's one of the things that put his whole career into a tailspin and led to its conclusion.
Well, Trump sure knows how to pick them, I have to say. But just in the last couple of minutes, Scott, what did you make of the latest expose in the New York Times about a meeting that the convicted child molester, George Nader, set up in Trump Tower with Don Jr. and with Eric Prince of the Mercenary Army, which is, by the way, based in the Emirates. He's close to MBZ, who pretty much runs the Emirates. And they had also set up a back channel in the Seychelles, involving the Russians, but it looks as if what Eric Prince was pitching to Don Jr. was, I've got the ability to start a war against Iran.
I think that's exactly right. And you know, this is the fifth expose piece in a series, and the New York Times and a couple of other publications have secured an immense cache, thousands of pages of email communications involving these individuals, and they've got some of them cooperating to some extent. And of course, we know George Nader is now a cooperating witness with Mueller in the Mueller probe. So I think all of this shows that it's not just the Russians who were seeking to intervene and influence the election. It's also the Saudis and the Emiratis. And I think what we see really also from the Elliot Broidy and George Nader connections is that the Russian, Saudi, and Emirati efforts to support Trump were interwoven. So some of these same individuals are involved with all three. I mean, for instance, I'll tell you, George Nader. I've now seen three photographs of George Nader taken in different years of him standing one by one next to Vladimir Putin. So he was constantly in Russia. And as you mentioned, this meeting that was set up with Eric Prince and the Seychelles involved Kirill Dmitriev, who the head of the Russian Investment Fund, and the Russian Investment Fund itself involved an awful lot of Emirati money. So these things are all intermingled.
Well, it is an amazing story, and if you say that the New York Times has got volumes of emails of all these players, then the assumption would be that Robert Mueller has even more, and that would lead me to suggest that little wonder Trump is trying to shut down Robert Mueller.
I think that's right, and I think certainly all the disclosures surrounding Elliot Broidy and George Nader figure right at the center of the current probe, and it really is a focus on follow the money. Now, let's remember Elliot Broidy, you know, had a couple of $100 million from the Emirates, and he was at the same time the deputy chair of the RNC Finance Committee. He was a leading fundraiser and gatherer for the Republican Party throughout this period. So they're obviously very suspicious that he was used as a conduit to bring Russian, Emirati, Saudi money into the Republican coffers.
So just in closing then, Scott Horton, do you think this is going to work for Trump to try and make this the smoking gun? He's just obviously looking for an excuse, and he's got the Fox Echo Chamber, he's got Nunes, he's got the Freedom Caucus. They're all going to beat the drum on this. I'm just astounded that anybody would take him seriously, but apparently, you know, at least 30 to 40% of the public do. And then Trump has succeeded in making this whole Russia inquiry a partisan issue, which is why so many people dismiss it.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's much like the furor they tried to make earlier about eavesdropping on Trump and Trump Tower, which really fizzled out and went nowhere. And in fact, you know, yesterday afternoon, I was chatting with two broadcast executives of a major German news service who told me they were going back and forth, you know, should we report this story or not? I mean, you know, it's getting such reverberations on Fox and in the Rupert Murdoch empire right now, but the story is so incredibly stupid. Most people look at it and say, like, why are you wasting our time with this? It's nonsense.
Well, Scott, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Great pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the elections today in Venezuela, where the choice is voting in a rigged election or boycotting the election.